So, tonight is the night we've all been waiting for, the question and answer session. So there were, Baruch Hashem, lots of questions, and hopefully we'll get through all of them. I think there are 16. So, number one, halachos related to ruach ra. Do you have to wash your hands outside the bathroom? Can you bring food into the bathroom? Where does the concept of ruach ra come from, since we're not superstitious? So first let's address the halachic question of the halachic status of the bathroom, and then we'll address the more hashkafic, philosophical question of the nature of ruach ra. So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Or HaChaim, Siman Daled, that if you leave a Beis HaKiseh or Beis HaMerchatz, you leave a bathroom, or, now we're not talking about our bathrooms, maybe an outhouse or something like that, or a Beis HaMerchatz, which is a place where they would bathe. So you need Netilas Yadayim. So obviously, washing in the bathroom wouldn't be helpful. And the Mishnah Berurah clarifies and says that's even if you didn't go to the bathroom. In other words, entering the room requires washing one's hands. It's not just relieving oneself. Now, why is that? So the Makor Chaim says that's because Ruach Ra'a Shora al Hayadayim. And the Zohar says something like that, that a person who enters the Beis HaKiseh, Lo Yivarech V'lo Yikra B'Torah Klal, until Netilas Yadayim outside of the bathroom. Now, if you say, the Makor Chaim argues, that if it's because they got dirty, well, it's not true. You didn't touch anything. You entered and you left, and you left your hands in the air the whole time. So they didn't get dirty. So the Makor Chaim says it must be because of Ruach Ra and the Beis HaKiseh. Okay, that's what he says. Now, if that's true, so then it would obviously be impossible to, let's say, wash your hands for a meal in the bathroom, because as soon as you left the bathroom, you have to wash your hands again. You couldn't wash your hands for bread in a bathroom. That's the halacha. And the Mishnah Berurah says this is true both with respect to a Beis HaKiseh and with respect to a Beis HaMerchatz. However, there are those that demonstrate that there is no Ruach Ra'a in a Beis HaMerchatz. How do they show that? Because the Gemara in Shabbos says that if a person is bathing, you can take a drink. There's a whole discussion about the bracha and this and that, but obviously that takes for granted that in a Beis HaMerchatz there is no Ruach Ra. And likewise the Sefer Aguda, which is one of the Rishonim, writes that Harotze Lishtos Litzimo Beis HaMerchatz V'yesher Levarach Sham Yivarech Beveis HaChitzon Al Menah Sheyuchal Lishtos Beveis HaPnimi. Can't make a bracha there, but you could drink there. So obviously, that means many poskim say there's no Ruach Ra. It's not a place where you'd make a bracha, but it's still a place where you could drink. So therefore, that it must be that there's only Ruach Ra in a Beis HaKiseh and not in a Beis HaMerchatz. And why is that? It's not so dirty. That's probably the simplest explanation. One way or the other, in terms of our bathrooms, where there is a toilet, so many poskim say that if you leave, you have to wash your hands. And that's not just because they got dirty while going to the bathroom, because even if you didn't go to the bathroom, the same halacha would apply. And that is the psak of many poskim. So, for example, Rav Avadia Yosef says, L'chatchila, you should follow this view. You should wash your hands after leaving a bathroom, though he thinks that's not true for a cheder ambatia. Now, remember, in Israel, oftentimes they had separate rooms, meaning to say there's the toilet room. Oftentimes the sink is not in the toilet room. The sink is either outside or in the bathroom. Bath, literally bathroom, room of the bath. So then he thinks you wouldn't need to wash your hands. But if you enter the toilet room, and in our homes, where almost all the time it's the toilet in the same room as the bath, as the sink, so then you would have to wash again. Now, some say that you could be makel nowadays. Why? Because the Shulchan Aruch says as follows: Beis Hakisei Shehu Bechafira Upiv Rachok Arba Amos Minaguma. Again, they had no plumbing, but you had a Beis Hakisei that was dug into the ground, and the entrance was 4 amos from the pit. Vasu B'Madron, it was on a slant, so that the urine would just roll down and out of the area that you're in. So then, basically, it lands up far away. So then, it might be okay. Hareza Doma L'Sasu M'Mutter L'Kros Bo Kriyashma Imein Bo Re'ach Ra. So, therefore, some say our bathrooms, where as soon as we go to the bathroom, we flush the toilet and that's it, shouldn't have the din of a Beis Hakisei. However, others say that is not a good analogy, because in our case, the tzoa, the feces, does stay in the bathroom until you flush. In that case, it immediately left. So this is a machlokas haposkim. Some poskim, like the Zakan Aaron, says you could be mekel. Others as well, they say our bathrooms don't have the halachic status of a Beis Hakisei, because you immediately flush the toilet as soon as you're finished. Yes, it's there for a couple of minutes, but it doesn't stay there. It's not like an outhouse. It's not like the old bathrooms that were discussed in Talmudic times, where the feces would remain there, and therefore it's okay. And others say no, that since it's there until you flush, it still has the status of a Beis Hakisei. Other poskim, like the Chazon Ish, are not sure about the topic, and therefore they say to be machmir. So there's really a consent of poskim. Some say our bathrooms have the din of Beis Hakisei, others say they don't, and others are mesupik. For example, Rav Moshe writes that you shouldn't wash for bread in our bathrooms, but you may wash your hands there before davening, even though you should try to dry your hands outside of the bathroom. In other words, it doesn't necessarily have the full-fledged status of a Beis Hakisei. That's why it's okay for davening, though preferably you should dry your hands afterwards. I'll read you what he says. Litol yadayim l'achila, ein yecholin af bevatei kisao shelanu, ulitfila im ein makom acher, yitol yadav sham, avalo yinag veim sham, elam yichotz l'Beis Hakisei, delatfila hasagi b'di'eved gam b'shas adchak sheminakin hayadayim v'lo gara zemehem. So you shouldn't wash for bread. Where there for bread, you actually need true netilas yadayim. What about for tefillah? So for tefillah, technically speaking, at least b'shas adchak, you should wash your hands before tefillah. But if you don't, if you dry your hands, that's good enough. So if you wash your hands in the bathroom and then you dry your hands outside of the bathroom, so at least you've dried your hands, and that would be okay. Pshita, he says, da'difa da'ko panim nikayon have v'lo yitztarech lahadir alayah l'kulei alma afla yesh farmitosis. Fine. But ideally, even for, no, because you have to wash your hands as soon as you leave. So according to Rav Moshe, you can't wash for bread in the bathroom at all, even if you dry your hands and make the brach outside. However, if you dry your hands outside, you wouldn't have to wash them again for things that, like davening or other things, right? So if, you know, ideally, let's say you go to the bathroom and you want to make an asher yatzar. Really, ideally for Rav Moshe, you would go to the bathroom and then wash your hands and dry your hands outside of the bathroom. However, if that's not easily available, often it's not. So then you wash your hands in the bathroom, you dry your hands outside of the bathroom, and you make an asher yatzar. However, other poskim disagree, as I mentioned. And the opinion of Rabbi Willig is that our bathrooms don't have the din of a Beis Hakisei. They're really much more like a multi-purpose room. If you had a bathroom that was only a toilet, again, like in Israel, might have the din of batei Beis Kisei Parsai and the like, without getting into the details. And then it might be the case that even in our bathrooms where we flush, you'd have to wash your hands after leaving the bathroom. However, our bathrooms are not that. Our bathrooms are multi-purpose rooms, essentially. There's a toilet there. There's also a bath. There's also a sink. People brush their teeth in their bathroom. They comb their hair in the bathroom. They do all sorts of things in the bathroom. Therefore, such a room does not have the halachic status of a bathroom, rather a multi-purpose room. And therefore, you can wash in there again, for al netilas yadayim, you should wash in the bathroom and make the bracha and then dry outside, because you shouldn't ideally be making brachos in the bathroom. Even though it's not 100% clear you couldn't, assuming it doesn't smell and assuming there's no tzoa in the bathroom at the time. But obviously the preferable thing to do, if you didn't have a sink, again, all things being equal, if you have to wash for netilas yadayim, the better place to do it is in a bathroom, in a sink outside the bathroom. But if that's not easily available, you could wash in the bathroom, then go out of the bathroom, make your bracha, and dry your hands after outside. And that is what Rav Willick thinks. And therefore, you'll see that many people, especially in America, follow this view. Not so much just in terms of netilas yadayim, but you'll notice that they don't wash their hands, again, in a sink outside of the bathroom. Eretz Yisrael, many poskim are more machmir about this. As I said, it is a big machlokas achronim, but I think many people do, in fact, follow the view that we said in the name of Rabbi Willick. Now to the philosophical aspect of this question, which is, what is the idea of Ruach Ra? So the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that there's Ruach Ra, which rests on the hands after you sleep. And therefore, prior to washing Nagel Vasser in the morning, a person should make sure not to touch the openings, such as the mouth, the nose, the ears, the eyes. And this is Paskind in Shulchan Aruch. Likewise, you should be careful not to touch food before washing Nagel Vasser. And the Mishnah Berurah cites this as well. What is this idea of Ruach Ra? So the Zohar teaches us that when a person falls asleep and remains inanimate, as it were, without thought or action, that is a taste of death. Sleeping is like 1/60th of death. And therefore, a spirit of impurity, of Ruach Ra, rests upon a person. Just like there's Tumah associated with death, so there's Ruach Ra associated with sleep. This is not superstition. This is a metaphysical reality. We're not dealing with something physical, presumably, but a metaphysical reality. Generally speaking, you'll see discussions of these metaphysical realities in more Kabbalistic sources. As I said, the Zohar discusses this at length, and the Zohar explains why it's specifically on the hands, and why it is that washing gets rid of it, and why you should wash three times, and dafka with a kli, and why on the right hand before the left hand. All these ideas are explained in the Zohar and other Kabbalistic sources, and that's the idea. So it's not superstition. There's a difference between superstition and certain metaphysical realities that we don't necessarily see with our eyes. Just like tumah is something that exists. It's not a physical thing. It's not something that you could see, but it has, does exist and has halachic consequences. So that is what the idea of Ruach Ra is. Now, it's hard for us to understand these things because ein lanu esek b'nistaros. But essentially the idea is that a person can harm themselves, at least harming themselves spiritually, by not being careful about these types of things. So if you touch food, if you touch your eyes and the like, that can cause some type of metaphysical or spiritual harm. However, some say that there's no Ruach Ra in the world anymore. Tosfos in Yuma writes, Umasha olam ein nizhar en achshav bezeh, lefi she'ein osa Ruach Ra shora be'elu hamalchios. Okay? And hence in Germany, there's no Ruach Ra anymore. Kemo she'ein nizhar en al hagiloi balazugos. We find other halachos in the Gemara that we're not so careful about. Giloi is the halach of leaving water uncovered. That might be because of snake poison, but Tosus implies it relates to this as well. Zugos is an idea in the Gemara that things that are in pairs are susceptible to, again, harm from certain spiritual harmful entities. And we're not worried about these anymore. Why would that be? We have no Ruach Ra anymore. Now, why would that be? Why would it be the case that in Talmudic times or in biblical times, there were these ideas of Ruach Ra, and nowadays they're gone. Where'd they go? Why not? So Reb Tzadok, a Kohen of Lublin, presents a very powerful explanation of this. He's talking about a similar concept, namely Kishuf. The simple reading of Tanakh is that Kishuf, magic, is something that exists. Not everybody agrees. Rationalists, like the Rambam, says it never existed. The psukim that describe the Chartumim of Paro, they were illusionists. They were great at sleight of hand. They were like David Copperfield and Houdini and the like. It wasn't real magic. But the simple reading of the psukim is that it is magic. And that's the view of many, many Rishonim. So why is it that, as far as I know, there isn't much magic anymore today? And what Reb Tzadok explains is as follows. There's a pasuk in Mishlei, Zeh l'umazeh bara Elokim. This keneged this Hashem created. What does that mean? In order for there to be bechira chashis, for there to be free will, a person has to have a meaningful choice. He has to be able to see two options. In a world where there were nisim geluyim, in a world where there was nevuah, there were also opposite powers. Hashem gave certain kochos to tap into spiritual forces, negative spiritual forces, to use for evil. These are forces, just like you could tap into the forces of nature and use them for evil. A person can build a gun and shoot a person. So there are spiritual, metaphysical forces in the universe as well. And a person can tap into these and use them for evil as well. That is part of free will. In a world where there were overt miracles, there was prophecy, so there was also false prophecy. There were the ability to tap into these harmful spiritual things, whether it's Shadim or Kishuf or the like. And those were things that existed in what we could call the first stage of Jewish history, the biblical stage. Again, there were 10 Nisim in the Beis HaMikdash every day. Or not every day, but these were Nisim Geluyim. Nisim Geluyim. And in that world, the Nisayon of a person was to see God and choose God as opposed to Avodah Zarah. People served Avodah Zarah because there were, again, powers that idolatrous priests could tap into and that attracted people to them and the like. Nobody was an atheist. There was clearly a supernatural forces in the world, but you didn't have to choose one God. Over the years, the nature of Bechira changed. Kadosh Baruch Hu, nowadays, we live in a world of Hester Panim, of divine hiddenness. There are more or less no overt miracles, there are no prophecy and the like. Our struggle is not with polytheism, but with atheism. We live in a world where it's easy for a person to deny God's existence or his providence or the like. And in this world, we don't really see the effects at all, and they might not even exist, of these harmful spiritual powers and forces and the like. And that's why Tosfos says that there is no longer Ruach Ra, and we're not so makbid about these halachos that emerge from Ruach Ra. The Lecha Mishnah also points out that the Rambam presumably agrees to this, because the Rambam never mentions Ruach Ra that appears in the Gemara. Now, that's also because the Rambam felt that he was a rationalist, and he thought that from a rational perspective, none of these things exist at all. How we explain the Gemara is an interesting question, but one way or the other, there are many Rishonim that seem to say you don't have to worry about it. And that's why many people, for example, are not makbid about the halacha, though we still wash Negel Vasser. There are multiple reasons for washing Negel Vasser, but they're not makbid for the halacha that you do it within four amos of your bed. There's really two reasons why some people are makel. Some people understand that the entire house is the halacha of Arba Amos, therefore it's okay to walk from your bed to your sink even if that's more than four amos, or because, like we said, there is no longer any Ruach Ra in the world. In fact, the Vilna Gaon is quoted as having said that there's a very famous story of a ger who lived in the time of the Vilna Gaon. He was of nobility, and his name was Graf Paczki or something like that. He lived in Poland. He was aristocratic, and he wanted to convert, and in fact he did convert. However, the Christians said that it is a capital offense, and if you don't return to Christianity and disavow your Judaism, you'll be burnt alive. And he refused. The Vilna Gaon famously visited him, and the Vilna Gaon said that at that point, when he was burnt, the Ruach Ra lost some of its strength, and especially regarding certain areas. And that's one of the reasons why Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, though they're not rationalists, they're mystical mystics, but they're not makbid about the halach of walking four amos before washing Nagel Vasser in the morning. So that is the reason why some people are not concerned about halachos relating to Ruach Ra and the like. And in one of the later questions, we'll address another reason why a person perhaps need not be concerned about things like Ruach Ra. But now I want to go on to the second question, because it's half hour and we didn't even get to question two. So we still have 15 more questions. Okay, number two. Do women count for panim chadashos et shever brachos? So this question might depend on why we need panim chadashos et shever brachos, which is a later question. So we might actually be able to kill two birds with one stone here. So why do you need panim chadashos et shever brachos? This seems to be a machlokas rishonim. This analysis of the machlokas rishonim is the way a number of achronim understand it, though it's not clear. There might be other ways to explain it. But the Rambam understands that the purpose of Sheva Brachos, when they're Panim Chadashos, is for people that didn't hear the Sheva Brachos at the Chuppah, or a previous meal where there were Sheva Brachos, and therefore they have an obligation to say Sheva Brachos. And thus, if there are no Panim Chadashos, then they've already, as it were, fulfilled their obligation to say Sheva Brachos. There's no need to say Sheva Brachos again. They were at the wedding, they were at a different Sheva Brachos, they heard Sheva Brachos. There's no longer a mitzvah to say Sheva Brachos. The way the Rambam puts it is, Avalim hayu ochlam acherim shalosham u birkas hanisuin b'shas hanisuin. There are people here that didn't hear the birkas hanisuin at the time of the wedding. Mevarchin b'shvilon, we make a bracha for them, or they can make a bracha. Achar birkas mazon Sheva Brachos, kedach shem mevarchin b'shas nisuin. Now, you could argue then that according to that opinion, someone who is not actually obligated to recite Sheva Brachos would not constitute Panim Chadashos. Why? Well, women don't have a chiyuv to recite Sheva Brachos. Perhaps why that is, we could talk about another time, but they don't. And therefore, there's no need, they wouldn't constitute Panim Chadashos, because there's the idea of Panim Chadashos is to be motzi the people who are still chayev and Sheva Brachos. The Rosh, though, disagrees. He says the obligation to recite Sheva Brachos is for the couple themselves. It's not for the people that missed the chuppah, it's for the couple. Not the community that's celebrating, but again, the couple. Now, what's the idea? That the couple has new excitement, their happiness is renewed when new people come. Because, you weren't at my wedding, but now I see you and you're joining in my celebration and my festivities. I'm so happy. And that new simcha warrants brachos. Now, seemingly, if you follow that view, women should constitute panim chadashos, because there's equal joy to seeing men and women who haven't participated. There should be no, since it's because of the simcha, there's no reason to distinguish. Now, therefore, you could make the case that the Shulchan Aruch in Evan HaEzer, Simen Samach Beis, seems to rule in accordance with the Rosh, that it relates to simcha, and therefore women should count as panim chadashos. However, the Pischei Tshuva over there quotes the Zecher Lavram, who says that they should not be considered panim chadashos. Now, there are those who disagree, arguing that we follow the Rosh, and according to the Rosh, women should count. I think the common practice, perhaps because of Safek Brachos LaHakel, is to try to have Sheva Brachos, to try to have Panos Chadashos that are men, though, again, it would seemingly depend on the reason. And I think there might be some poskim that are makel, because they say we are Yupaskin like the Rush. The reason, because of joy, there should be no difference. But again, it seems that the common practice is to be machmir about this. Oftentimes, when it comes to Safek Brachos, we are makel. We're Safek Brachos Kula, meaning say we won't make a bracha if we're not sure a bracha should be made. Okay, number three, I can't say I understood this question. So, yes. No, you don't need that. That's a little different. There's no need for Sheva Brachos at the wedding, for Panim Chad at the wedding, I believe. So number three, as I said, I wasn't sure. If you ask this question, you want to clarify, you can. This was the question: why in the world do we require so much sleep? Is it in and of itself significant, or simply a means to function throughout the day? So I don't know, you know. Pashupshat is actually the biological reason for sleep, I think, is something that scientists don't quite fully understand. There are different theories about it, why it is that we need so much sleep and the like. But I assume whoever was asking the question wasn't asking for a scientific explanation, but a more spiritual explanation. So I don't know. But there is an idea that sleep doesn't just provide us with physical renewal, but also spiritual renewal. Idea that our neshama goes up to shamayim, it sort of taps into certain ideas when we're asleep. We talked about this before in terms of the obligation for Nagel Vasser and the like. And Chadashim, that waking up in the morning is like a new lease on life. Certainly, it's something we feel all the time. Sometimes we go to sleep and we're beat up from a rough, tough day. We wake up and we feel better. And spiritually, we're told that perhaps a similar type of thing happens. It's renewal for the neshama as well. There's a very interesting idea that sleep also relates to dreams. The truth is, psychologists understand, and neuroscientists, that one of the things that sleep does for us is allows our thoughts to settle and develop and think in certain ways, and that without sleep, it's not just physical needs, but it's our mental health is affected. And dreams as well, on a spiritual level, do have meaning. So I think there's a lot of fascinating ideas that relate to sleep, and perhaps it is something to think more about, but I'd like to go on to question four. What do you do when you get to shul late? Do you daven with the minyan, or daven to yourself? Do you wait till Kriyas HaTorah is over, if it's already started? This is a tough question. So, let's say a person arrives in shul and finds that the congregation has already started. So, if saying everything would keep them from being mispalel b'tzibur, what is tefillah b'tzibur? Tefillah b'tzibur is saying Shmona Esrei with the kahal. So then, they may skip certain things, but they may not skip other things. The reason they may skip certain things is because tefillah b'tzibur is one of the important aspects of davening b'tzibur. Davening b'tzibur allows us a number of things. It allows us to say Dvarim Shebekedusha, to answer to Kaddish and Kedusha, which is, of course, a very big mitzvah, L'Kaddish Es Hashem V'Rabim. The Ramban writes how when Klal Yisrael get together and they publicly declare their faith in God, that is a fulfillment of an essential purpose of their world's creation, in fact. But davening b'tzibur as well is something that is very important and powerful. And therefore, you can skip certain things. So certain things you can't skip because you have to do them before davening. So saying Al Netilas Yadayim or Birkas HaTorah or the like can't be skipped. We won't skip Kriya Shema uBirchoseha because we want to be so mechula l'tfila. We want to make sure, at least for Shachris, Marv might be different, but for Shachris we want to first say Shema and the Brachos and Shema and then say Shemon Asrei. So if you get to Shul and they've already started Birkas Kriya Shema, let's say, there's certainly no point in skipping because anyway you're not going to get to Tfila B'Tzibur. However, you can skip parts of Psukei D'Zimra. We'll talk about which parts in a moment. And even, if necessary, all of Psukei D'Zimra. You can make up the Psukei D'Zimra afterwards, though you can't re-say Baruch She'amar Nishtabach. You would say Psukei D'Zimra after davening, but skipping Baruch She'amar Nishtabach. In addition, you could say Birkas HaShachar, the other Birkas HaShachar, after davening is over. Now, obviously, this isn't ideal, and Chazal were misaking Psukei D'Zimra because it's proper to sing the praises of Hashem before Tefillah. And not only that, but Psukei D'Zimra is something that prepares us for Tefillah, sort of like warm-ups. It gets us into the spirit and into the mood and the like. Sometimes a lot harder to daven mincha when all we have is Ashrei than Shachris, when we've had more time to say Psukei D'Zimra and prepare ourselves. And in fact, you could argue that if skipping Psukei D'Zimra is going to negatively affect your kavana, then perhaps it's more important to daven b'kavana than to skip Psukei D'Zimra, even if you would get tefillah b'tzibur, because tefillah b'kavana, in a sense, is really the most important of the things. But if a person does choose to skip Psukei D'Zimra, so what should they do? So minimally, they should say Baruch She'amar Ashrei Enishtabach. If you have a little more time, you should say Kapitel Kuf Hei. If you have more time, Kuf Mem Ches. These are in the Halalukas. 3 and 5, meaning to say the Halalukas, are the most important. 5 being the most important, then 3. If you have enough time, you say all 5. Beyond that, if you have more time, you say Vayivarach David. If you have more time, you say Hodu until the Hurachum, skipping from the Hurachum, saying the Hurachum and then skipping to Ashrei, and the like. If it's Shabbos, so the weekday Mizmorim take precedence over the special editions for Shabbos, but if you do have time to say some of the Shabbos ones, so then Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos comes first, as well as Halal HaGadol, the Todu LaShem Ki Tov, at least on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. Right, well, Yomim Tovim might be a little different. Anyway, then 19, 34, and 90, if you remember all these things. One thing that's important to keep in mind for Psukei D'Zimra is Tov me'at tachanunim bekavana meharbe below kavana. I think there's no doubt that it is better to say half of Psukei D'Zimra slowly and meaningfully than to say all of Psukei D'Zimra super quick. And even if you come on time, it's okay to skip parts of Psukei D'Zimra so that you could say them slowly. I guess the ideal in that case, if you know you need to, the tzibur is going too fast for you, you should get there early and start Psukei D'Zimra early. But if you didn't, and you've come on time, but they're still moving too quickly for you, I find that's very frequently the case for me. So even if you come on time, you might find yourself skipping. Now, the question is, would these halachos be any different for women? Or would they be the same? So perhaps you would argue that they are different, because women are not chayavos to daven in a minyan and in a shul in the way that men are. And therefore, you could argue that since the reason for skipping is because of tefillah b'tzibur, and women are not chayavos in tefillah b'tzibur, because that is lizman grama, there is a debate among the Rishonim and Poskim exactly the extent of the nature of women being chayavos to daven in the first place, but certainly tefillah b'tzibur, abizman, and the Beis HaKnesses is something that women are not chayavos in. And that being the case, then it doesn't make sense to skip. On the other hand, you could argue, and I think this makes more sense, that even though women are not chayavos to be mispalo b'tzibur, however, there's a tremendous maila to tefila b'tzibur that applies equally to women as to men. And just like we say the tefila of men are more powerful than when b'tzibur, than when b'yachid, so too the tefilos of women are more powerful b'tzibur than b'yachid. So, therefore, tefila b'tzibur for women is a gewaldic opportunity, and we would say that if you can skip, and that won't, like we say, adversely affect your kavana, so then women would skip in the same way that men do. Now, again, it's very interesting, actually. If you look at the Rishonim, at least some of the Rishonim, like in many of the Ashkenazi Rishonim, it was clear that women were regularly davening in shul. In fact, the number of Ashkenazi Rishonim took for granted that women went to shul for Maariv, which is fascinating because nowadays it's nearly unheard of. But there were women in the times of Rishonim who clearly did regularly attend shul. It's not like a modern idea. The Medrash states explicitly a number of Midrashim about women davening in shul and the powerful effects therein. There's one Medrash that says, this is from the Yalkut Shimoni, Maisha Bisha Achash, Shizkina Me'od, Achakatza B'chaya. This is a fascinating Medrash because it relates to end-of-life issues. But we won't look at it from that perspective now. She davened, she was very, very old. And Katza B'chaya, she felt she couldn't or didn't want to live any longer. She had enough of life. She was very old. So she came before Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta, and she said to him, Rabbi, zakanti yoser midai, I'm too old. U'me'achshav chayim shel nivolheim. She'eni to'emes lo macha v'lo mishta. I don't enjoy my life. I don't taste food. I don't taste drink. V'ani mevakeshes li'pater min ha'olam. I would like to leave this world. Now, she knew she can't suicide. That's certainly asur. So she says, what should I do? What should I do? So it's very interesting. He didn't say to her, you know, give her a musr shmuz about how every moment in life is precious and the like. Rather, he tried to help her out. So he said to her, Be'ezem mitzvah at regila lahakbid b'chol yom. There must be some mitzvah that you do every day. Your zocha to such a richos yamim. What is it? What is your zchus? So Amrlo, she said to him, Regila anisha filu yesh li davar chaviv, even if I have something very chaviv, important, special to do, ani menicha oso umashkemes l'beis haknesis b'chol yom. I get up early and go to shul every day. So Amrlo, I said to her, okay, I have simple advice. Meni atzmeich mi beis haknesis shlosha yamim. Don't come to shul for 3 days. She did that. On the third day, she got sick and died. So, you see from here a number of fascinating lessons. As I said, one, this source might relate to the discussion of end-of-life issues. Is it always necessary to pursue every possible treatment to extend life when it's not a life that the person wants to live? But that's an interesting discussion, though, not for now. What's relevant for now, as you see for here, the gewaldic schus of davening b'tzibur, that's true for men and for women. I was recently reading the biography of Rebbetzin Kanievsky, and it mentioned how when she had young children and the like, she couldn't go to shul for many years. That wouldn't have been possible. But after her children grew up and she no longer had to be at home to care for them, so she started regularly attending shul and the Liederman shul, except for certain occasions when she had a certain cheshbon, Erev Shabbos and the like, when she didn't go to shul, but otherwise she did go to shul. So, that being the case, I'm not necessarily advocating whether you should go to shul every day or you shouldn't. There's a lot of questions that go into that equation, because for most people that are using their life efficiently, so coming to shul comes at a cost, and once it's not an obligation, you have to make the cheshbon. It's going to take away from something else, and what makes more sense? That's certainly true with respect to young children, where it's usually going to be impossible to regularly daven in shul, but even not one that women that are doing good things with their time, other mitzvos, other productive things, since it's not an obligation, should make the cheshbon. But if you are going to go to shul, then it is definitely the case that davening b'tzibur is a good thing, and therefore I do think it would make sense to skip in order to make tefillah b'tzibur. Now, that's when you're coming to shul like 15 minutes late. So then this whole discussion is relevant, because you know you could skip to catch up and daven tefillah b'tzibur and the like. What about if you come to shul an hour late or the like? So then things are much more complicated, because you really shouldn't be skipping, because anyway you're going to miss tefillah b'tzibur. And davening during laning is not ideal, because during laning you should be listening to the Kriyas HaTorah, and almost to like turn away from the Kriyas HaTorah, even to do other good things, isn't necessarily so appropriate. On the other hand, you want to catch up because maybe you'll at least be able to get Musaf b'tzibur. So maybe it does make sense to daven. Not so clear what the right thing to do is in that case. An Isha Chashuva once told me that when she's planning to come to shul very late, so she davens at home. Anyway, it's hard to daven b'kavana when the wrong things are happening, because you hear the laning, you hear this, you hear that. You know, imagine when you're listening to a scintillating drasha from the rabbi, it's hard to focus on Shmon Esrei. So maybe in cases like that, at least if you do have a quiet place to daven at home, it would make sense to daven shachris at home, and then come to shul whenever you get to shul, if you get to shul in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah, so you'll hear the end of Kriyas HaTorah, and you'll be able to be mekayem tefillah b'tzibur for musaf and answer to kaddish and kiddush and the like, all those which are gevaldic things, and not have to be distracted and be doing something different than everybody else and the like. Perhaps that makes a little more sense. Okay. Yes?
Let's say you're like an hour and a half late. So then, I heard it was if you daven shachris when the
Yilat yeah. davening. So that might be the case. That's a good point. You might be Mekayim, or to many posts, can feel a tzibur, if you're davening together with the tzibur, even if not davening the same thing. Other posts can disagree with that. They say tefillah b'tzibur is davening the same thing with the tzibur, the whole kal getting together and davening the same thing. But yeah, you could definitely argue for that. So you daven shachris when they daven musaf, when you daven musaf, you could daven musaf later. You could daven musaf along with chazar sashatz. Right. So in other words, this isn't a full kiyum of tefillah b'tzibur, but one thing you could do when you come late. So if you're not going to start Shmon Esrei with the tzibur, you're going to start there halfway through. So you might have missed tefillah b'tzibur, but even if you start now, then it's tarti l'reisa, because you're going to end up missing tefillah b'tzibur, plus you're going to end up missing kedusha. So one thing you could do at that point is daven along with the chazan. If you daven along with the chazan, then you could answer, or you say the Shmona Esrei of the chazan, basically, along with him, which includes kedusha. And that's an option that you could do when you're late for anything. For let's say mincha, you get to mincha, they're in the middle of mincha. So if you know that you start Shmon Esrei now, you're going to miss kedusha. So wait a minute or two for the chazan to start, and then you say it along with the chazan. So I guess what you could do is you could daven the shachris during the silent Shmona Esrei, and then Musaf along with the Chazan. Okay, chick chak, you did the whole davening in 10 minutes. Okay, I was hoping that people wouldn't ask questions that I didn't get to read. Yes?
So let's say you realize you're very late, and you leave the shul and wait outside the door and finish davening there, catching up.
Okay.
Not in the shul area, but you can still hear.
If you're in a different room, then you're in a different room. You could answer Kedusha even though you're in a different room. meaning to say...
Is it the appropriate thing to do those to leave if you're like in a different room you're not?
Maybe, maybe. Yeah, you could do that. I mean, davening in the hallways also isn't so nice. But perhaps, perhaps that would be better if it helps. Again, a lot of this is personal. Meaning to say, so much of tefillah is being able to daven with kavanah. And what distracts one person is different than what distracts another person. If davening in shul will be very distracting, but stepping outside and davening outside will be less distracting, either for you or for others, then that's something that might make a lot of sense. If davening in the hallway is even more distracting because people are talking and their kids running around and the like, then obviously it's not a good choice. Okay, let's do at least one more question. Number 5, is making salad dressing an issue of molid? So I don't know why it would be molid, but let's discuss what molid is, and then we could figure out why making salad dressing might or might not be an issue of molid. So the Gemara in Shabbos says that you can't crush ice or snow, but you could put it into a glass on Shabbos. So why is it that you can't crush snow? What's wrong with crushing snow on Shabbos? So there are 3 approaches in the Rishonim. The Rashba writes that it's some form of schita, just like you can't squeeze a grape to get the juice out, so perhaps squeezing the water out of snow would be a similar thing. Rashi writes, it's because you're being molded on Shabbos, and it's similar to a melacha. How so? Maybe because you're creating something new. Now it's snow, and you're turning it into something new, namely water. Melachos are creative acts, and this is something that resembles a creative act, and therefore would be problematic, at least midirabbanan. And a third possibility, the Sefer HaTrumah says it's because of not molid, but nolad. Nolad is a category of muksa. The resulting water would be nolad, because again, it's a new creation, a newly created item, and therefore it would be prohibited. So, one way or the other, the halacha is, you can't crush snow on water, snow into water on ice. Now, you could put ice cubes into your drink. That's no problem. What about other examples? So can you make ice on Shabbos? Maybe you would argue, if you learn, like Rashba's reading or the Sefer Truma's reading, presumably it wouldn't be a problem, right? There's no issue of schita in making ice. But maybe if you hold like molid, so you're making something new by changing the state, that would be a problem. This is a machlokas haposkim, and you think the better thing is to be machmir if you don't really need ice cubes, not to make ice cubes on Shabbos, though perhaps if it's a real need, it would be mutter. What about making something new, changing the form, by making a foam, like making whipped cream on Shabbos? Our stuff is as a liquid, and then you spray it out of the aerosol, and somehow or another that puffs it up, and now it's whipped cream, sort of a quasi-solid. So therefore, there are some poskim who are machmir, that's also similar to this iser of molid or the like. Others disagree. I believe Rav Moshe disagrees, Rabbi Willig disagrees, for different reasons, actually. But he doesn't think this is really changing the form. So Rabbi Willig thinks it's okay to use foam soap dispensers on Shabbos also, even though it bubbles them up into something like a foam. He thinks that's mutter. Anyway, I don't know why making a salad dressing, though, would fall into any of these categories, because it starts off as a liquid, and it ends up as a liquid, and you're just mixing together different ingredients, you know, oil and vinegar, the like, so I don't know why that would be molded. Squeezing a lemon might be schita. You can't squeeze a lemon into salad dressing. That's correct.
Measuring
could be an issue as well, if it's measuring, but molded... In other words, whatever issues come up, you have to deal with them there. Generally speaking, you shouldn't use precise measuring on Shabbos, and you shouldn't squeeze. If you want to squeeze the lemon into sugar, if you're putting sugar into your salad dressing, that you could probably do according to many poskim, and then squeeze the lemon to the sugar and mix the sugar into the salad dressing. But you shouldn't squeeze the lemon into the salad dressing. So, yes. You what? I didn't. Oh, frozen cubes. think so. It starts as a solid and it ends as a solid. They just it's not changing the state of basil.
Yeah.
It just happens to be frozen for purposes of so it doesn't spoil, I would assume, and the like. I don't know why that would be an issue. Okay. All right, we have one more time. Time for one more. What are Rabbi Wiederblank's thoughts? Oh, that's me. I want to tell you a funny story about when I was preparing for this. There was a Shiloh later on. We didn't get to it yet. And I was getting very tired. I was preparing these late at night, and I didn't know how I was supposed to answer it. So I figured, why should I answer questions? I'll just Google it. So that's the way everybody answers Shilohs nowadays. So I Googled it. So I got to this fascinating website called Miodea, which is a Jewish stack exchange, which apparently is a forum where you ask a question and whoever wants to answer. So I was curious, I guess really procrastinating writing the shiur. This reminded of it because we're talking about internet filters. So I was looking around. So like all internet things, you know, some of them are good and some of them are lousy and some of them are totally wrong and some of them are half right. I remember when I was, I think, in 11th grade, we got Prodigy. This was like before the internet, before the World Wide Web. They had the World Wide Web. You had to pay more for that. And so we got this thing called Prodigy. And it was like a small version, but it had Ask the Rabbi. So I looked at the Ask the Rabbi thing, and the answers were so atrocious, I decided that I would do a better job answering the questions. I was not a rabbi, and it's probably a very bad thing to do, but anyway, I started answering these questions. So I was looking around on this Neodea site, and I saw a question that looked interesting, and then I saw the answer. They quoted me. they quoted a shiur that was on YU Torah, and the like. So anyway, so back to this question. Are you allowed to, internet filters, smartphone filters, what filters are installed? Are boys in YU encouraged to install it? I think it's a very good idea to have filters on internets or phones or the like, especially for guys that are single, when the Yetzer Hara is particularly difficult. Doesn't mean that a person who's married doesn't have that Yetzer Hara either. Married men have pornography issues as well, but it's obviously more difficult for those who are single. The Yetzer Hara is very, very, very hard. Not even when people are just looking for it, but because all sorts of things pop up all the time without your intending to go there. And it's really a challenging nisayon. And we know that when facing a nisayon, a person, if they have the opportunity to avoid the nisayon, shouldn't just say, well, I'm going to face this nisayon and beat the nisayon, but they should do what they can to avoid temptation. Sometimes you can't, sometimes you can. So filters are definitely a very good idea. I think for a family, what Rabbi Willig suggests, and you could do this as well, is to treat the internet as an iser yichud, meaning to say, don't be alone with the internet. So if you have a family computer, don't put the computer in a public area where people will be, we're makel for yotzei v'nichnas, perhaps for yichud, so you could be mixed where people will see what you're doing. And when you're in that situation, naturally a person is much less likely to get into trouble. At the end of the day, a person has to know what they, their own weaknesses and what, like everything, a person who's a struggling or a recovering alcoholic, it's not smart to walk by a liquor store or a bar when they're walking home from work, even if their regular route takes them in front of a liquor store. Probably they should find a different route. because that temptation every time they pass by is going to be something that's extremely hard to deal with. And likewise, if it is possible to have a filter, you have filters, and something that is a nisayon that a person struggles with, and a person has to know themselves, then this is something that they should take care of, and they should take that responsibility. And certainly, if in the family setting, where a person has kids that are of an age, that this is an issue, so they have to be careful about that. And I should note, by the way, that the internet isn't just a problem in terms of pornography. It's a huge problem in terms of kfira. And this, too, is an issue with kids as well as adults. But kids are especially susceptible because they don't always know how to respond to things like that. And it's very easy to be legitimately looking for, you know, doing your homework, your chumash homework, and deciding to use the internet and end up reading horrible things. The Rambam writes, "Lo sasur achrei levavchem v'achrei neichem," means you can't look at things that are going to create a yetzer hara in a person for lust as well as for kfira. So a person has to be very careful about both of these things. And I think educationally we have to make sure that we teach everyone to respond to both of these things. Number one, how to deal with the problem when you do encounter inappropriate things on the internet, because inevitably that will happen. And simply saying, well, get a filter, we'll solve the problem, won't. And likewise with respect to kfira, how to deal with kfira, how to answer questions and the like. And I think we just mentioned some of the incredible Torah resources and wonderful things that the internet provides, and it does. And whether we like it or not, it's pretty difficult to function nowadays without the internet at all. So a person has to do two things. They have to take appropriate precautions, and they also have to learn how to respond and build within them the strength to be able to deal with these challenges, because they will inevitably happen. So I think a balanced approach about this is really what makes sense, and what that means for different people at different stages in life is very different. But there is no doubt that it's a very sad reality that internet really causes devastates people spiritually and psychologically, whether it's kfira or pornography or the like. And people mamish suffer tremendously because of it. They suffer not just because of the interactions, but then the guilt that follows afterwards. And addiction is a real thing. It's something that really causes a lot of pain, emotional pain. I'm not just talking about the spiritual harmful effects. It's a real thing, and a lot of times people only start solving the problem after they're very deep into the problem. And I think, thankfully, it's an issue that many more people are aware of the problem and the need for solutions, and there are many more resources for solutions, and there are all sorts of programs that help deal with it. You mentioned the boys in YU. So when I was going to college, the internet existed. I'm not so old, and the problem of pornography on the internet existed, and nobody was really talking about it, and there weren't filters. And nowadays, I think that it's a problem that people are addressing, whether it's filters and technology, whether it's Shmir Seinayim clubs, whether it's these programs where, you know, you have a buddy and they see where you went on the internet and all sorts of different programs, and many of them are really good. And since I think we don't advocate leaving the world, one has to figure out how best to remain engaged in the world, but at the same time protect themselves. And that's a very difficult thing, but it's something that everybody has to think about, both men and women and families and the like. So on that note, we'll stop here. If this is interesting, we could continue from question 7 next time. Well, next time I think we said we're going to do something Rosh Hashanah related next Monday night. Also next Monday night, for those interested, we will have Hataras Nedarim after the Shir at 9:30. So I guess during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, we could do it. So we can we'll pick up the Monday after Rosh Hashanah, and we could continue going through these questions. And I suppose if you want to send Lisa some more questions, we could do that. Okay, so have a good night.